I changed the title a little bit relative to what is in the Book of Abstract to essentially include one more result, and that which is very new, and that also has increased the list of authors. So I will also show parts of work done together with Joanna Scherban, who is here, and with Enrique Solano from Munich, and who is actually really based in Peru. So the plan of the talk is, so the main punchline of the talk will be that we are going to look at decoherence effects in superconducting qubits, which are a well-controlled and understood system by now, which go beyond the typical approximations most people really love. So these, if you read them backwards, this is basically in decreasing brutality. So the Markov approximation, the approximation that the decoherence is described by an equation which is local in time, turns out to be a very strong one. The Born approximation, the assumption that your coupling to the environment is relatively weak, for most systems which are reasonable qubits, is a much better one already. And the Gauss approximation, which means that your system is a very generic and true heat bath, is something where you can actually ask yourself, is this ever going to be violated? But I will show examples for violation of all those three, and how we can deal with these systems, how we can understand the validity of these approximations. But before doing this, I will actually introduce how we think about decoherence in superconducting circuits, how they're supposed to work with, because not everybody has this in their background. So I thought I'd spend a few minutes on introduction in a more tutorial style on how these things work, and then explain decoherence from the electronic circuitry, because that will be the source of examples for this more theoretical part in the end. Also, the main other decoherence channel, namely slow fluctuations in the material, will be extensively covered by Jan in the next talk. So we are going to go over this. Then I talk about a very new result on the realization of a nonlinear cavity system, and introduce something to you which we nicknamed the Faith-Purcell effect, and then spend quite a while on visibility. So basically talk about a model where you can quantify the non-Markovian contributions pretty well. So let's start here. And let's start very simply. We want to study quantum physics of electronic circuits. For those of you who have been at the previous workshop, the first couple of slides you have seen already last week. How would we set up quantum theory of simple electronic circuits? Let's start with this example of a simple LC resonator. If you write down the circuit equations here, we see that the magnetic flux through here is given by the current through the coil times the inductance. The current charges and uncharges the capacitor, which gives us the CV dot term, and the change of the voltage here is connected to the next derivative of the flux here by the law of induction, and this is how we get the what we learned probably in our first year at university, the harmonic oscillator equation of motion for magnetic flux in this circuit. Now, how would we do this more formally? Well, in essence, we are doing what we learn when we study physics, when we quantize mechanics, which is we first do classical mechanics in a formal way. We write down the Lagrange function for the system, which leads to this equation of motion. Now, the Lagrange function has ambiguities. For example, classically, it's only defined up to a prefactor. But there is a microscopic derivation of all what I'm showing you, including superconductivity and endorsement system elements, done by Ambega-Oka, Eckhorn, and Schön, which fixes all this. So what you're seeing here is how to work with this result and not how it's derived. But, okay. So here is the Lagrange function, and it contains, it's written using the flux as a coordinate. It has a kinetic energy term, which physically is the charging energy of the capacitor. It has a potential energy term, which physically is the inductive energy in the coil. And this is a typical form for harmonic oscillator. The first thing you can do is you figure out if phi is the coordinate, then what is the momentum? You get this by the derivative of the Lagrange function, and you see the canonical momentum is the charge on the capacitor plate. And by this you can write down the Hamiltonian, and then there is summer break, and you're going to quanta one, and you learn that if you have a Hamiltonian written in terms of coordinate and momentum, then you quantize it by assuming that these two guys are operators and that they have a canonical commutation relation. Yep.
How is that commutation relation consistent with the fact that you actually
have integer eigenvalues? Here Q, why does Q have integer eigenvalues here? It would be displacement charge. So here Q is a displacement charge, basically polarization. It does not have integer eigenvalues. However, if you go to junctions, the flux gets replaced by a phase. It becomes periodic, and then Q has integer eigenvalues. And then this is not the right way of writing the commutation relation, but you can equally write it down for raising and lowering operators. And this is all you need. Yeah. And in all the derivations I do, you in fact only need that that cosine phi raises or lowers, or e to the I phi plus or minus I phi raises or lowers the charge. That's all you need. And indeed, this brings us to Josephson junctions, because if we want to build a qubit, we need non-linearity. Systems like an oscillator with equal level splitting don't give us qubits. We need a nonlinear element, and in a superconducting system, that's very naturally the Josephson junction. Here are two pieces of superconducting metal. The conduction electrons all condense into a collective state, which can be described by a single wave function. So instead of behaving like a 10 to the 10 particle system, they behave like a one particle system with charge 10 to the 10. This is, again, very much simplified, but on this level, you can understand, you can get an idea about things. And this wave function you can decompose into modulus and phase, both on the left and on the right of this junction, which is two pieces of superconductor separated by an insulator. And then the Josephson relations tell us, so this is the essence of the Josephson effect, that you can have a dissipationless current across the junction, which is proportional to the sine of the phase difference. And that is true for a weakly coupled tunnel junction, and that's all we're interested in here. And that the phase velocity is essentially, that's the basic quantum mechanical consequence of quantum mechanics and of gauge invariance. The phase velocity is proportional to the energy offset between the two leads, and that is given by 2E, because that's the charge of a Cooper pair, times the voltage. Now, these two equations, you can describe the Josephson effect in this junction. But on top of this, this is, of course, two pieces of metal separated by a dielectric. So it also has an intrinsic capacitance, like the capacitor on the last slide. So on top of this current, you can have a displacement current, capacitance times voltage dot, in here, which by this relation you can express by the second derivative of the phase. And here we introduce the quantum of magnetic flux, H over 2E, which is a quantum mechanical unit for magnetic flux. Usually, unless you're in certain special situations, of course, magnetic flux is not strictly quantized. And so this unit we need. And by this analogy, you can already see that in our Lagrangian game, the Josephson junctions enters as a potential energy term, contains the phase. And that turns out to be 1 minus cosine phi times this prefactor, which contains the critical current. So here's another ingredient for playing with Josephson circuits, with superconducting circuits. That's the Josephson circuit potential. So this is the circuit diagram. Here's the junction, its capacitance, and you can put this into one symbol if you want. Now, for steering this, there's another tool which comes in handy, and that's fluxoid quantization. So you put many of these junctions into a loop, and now you wander around the loop. Say you start here. You're going from here to there. The wave function picks up a geometric phase, essentially like in the Ahern-Bohm effect, which is proportional to 2e times the line integral over the vector potential. And then you're crossing a junction, and at the junction, the phase jumps, because that's the Josephson phase drop. And if you go around once, you're jumping a few times, and you're collecting vector potential until you made one full loop. And what you're getting on your wave function should be an integer multiple of 2 pi, because the wave function has to be single valued. And if you work all this out, you see that the sum over phase drops can be controlled by the magnetic flux. So cool, we can control the phases here without attaching any leads to it. Now that provides us a toolbox for building superconducting qubits, and there's many ways how you can use this toolbox. There's a whole family, and let me introduce you and partially just repeat what Roger Koch said, but repetition after lunch is probably not always bad. So let's introduce you to my favorite member of the family, which is the flux qubit. Here we have three junctions in a loop. The fundamental qubit states are clockwise and counterclockwise current, and they can be detected by the magnetic field they produce. So what you see around here is a DC squid, which is made from the same type of superconducting technology, and which is a very sensitive detector for magnetic fields. And the size of here is a couple of microns, so this is actually a pretty microscopic object. The current carrying states here involve about 10 to the 10 electrons. So this is again the circuit diagram. It has three junctions, it has one constraint because it's this loop, and so you get a two-dimensional potential landscape, and if you do some cut through here, which is very detailed, not very exciting, you're seeing that as a function of the average of those two phases, the potential energy has a double well form if the magnetic flux through here is close to half a flux quantum. The states in the minima of the well correspond to clockwise and counterclockwise current. And now if you tune the parameters in the correct way, if you make the device with the right parameters, you have one bound state per minimum, and you have them close enough to the top of the barrier such that they can tunnel from left to right. You get a coherent tunnel coupling, and the next bound states are relatively high up. So if you are not operating with too high frequency, you're not using them. So based on this, you would assume that in the basis of these current eigenstates, the Hamiltonian looks like this. Here is the diagonal, the classical energy of these wells, and it's zero at half a flux quantum. And then if you go away, you pay a little bit of inductive energy, which is proportional to the circulating current in this state. And you should have a tunnel matrix element through here, which we call delta. And the first test you have to do, this is an experiment done in Hans Moy's group in 2000, is to check whether this is the Hamiltonian. So you're doing spectroscopy, you're shining in microwave, you're recording the resonance frequencies as a function of the magnetic flux, which should be here, and you see that the spectroscopic peaks, if you're far out, they're on this straight line, which would correspond to no coupling, which is just these two terms. But if you're close to half a flux quantum, you get level repulsion, and that tells you that these tunnel splittings are, in this experiment, of the order of half a gigahertz. So cool, this seems to be the right Hamiltonian. Now, that experiment had very broad lines. The coherence was not very well understood, but there were lots of improvements. In 2003, Hans Moy's group showed Rabi oscillations. So they showed they could, by driving with microwaves, pump the system between two eigenstates, which gives you, if you want, an quantum logical X gates. And they could show Ramsey fringes, which is you pump halfway, let the system go, pump again halfway, which corresponds to the other single qubit rotation. And so this seems to be really working well. Now, in this experiment from 2003, the dephasing time T2 star, which means the dephasing time after lots of averaging in an ensemble, was 15 nanoseconds. There has been a recent paper. Sorry, I'm a bit stingy with references, but ask me if you want. There was a paper in 2005 where Hans Moy's group showed that with echo, they could push that up to 4 microseconds, which is a very, very impressive number, because most of the noise is very slow, so it can be considered as an inhomogeneity. And this, again, is what Jan will talk about. So this is setting the stage. These are the type of systems we're interested in. Let me skip over this and directly go to decoherence from the electronic circuitry. Now, as I said, this is a very nice test bed and playground for decoherence. It's for practically optimizing these devices. This is not the present frontier, but it will warm us up for the theoretical part. So a very generic system for describing decoherence in a two-state system is the spin boson Hamiltonian, which has been intensely studied at least since the 1980s, which has the following form. Here we have Pauli operators, and here there should also be a Pauli operator, sorry, so this should be 1/2 times Z, and this term. which describe the qubit. So here's our flux bias, here's our tunnel splitting. It couples to the coordinates of a bath of harmonic oscillators. And this, in this case, should couple by Z, because it turns out that what we're mostly interested in is noise of the magnetic flux. A magnetic flux was the Z observable in our previous theory. We could rotate this to any direction, but in the case of this system, actually the historically important direction is the right one. So first of all, we've introduced these harmonic oscillators. So we introduced extra degrees of freedom. But the way how to characterize, but they can be characterized by a single function, namely the spectral density, the density of states, which is a continuous function which essentially counts all these single oscillator modes in terms of the coupling strength. So we can consider this as a fluctuating force from a heat bath. Yep. This is coupled to the qubit. Yes, here I forgot a Z. So the system bath interaction is 1/2 Z, Pauli Z operator, times some. That is the correct system bath term. Sorry for that. So this can be viewed as a fluctuating force, this part. And again, I'm missing a sum. So this is the fluctuating force, X. So I'm missing a sum here. So you can view this as we have some heat bath which is executing a fluctuating force, which classically would just be a fluctuating force on our system. And quantum mechanically, it can entangle with our system and do all kinds of more sophisticated things. So the first thing is, now this is basically, if you want an ansatz, let's check how we can match that with reality. And the way how to do this is, you are looking at the noise spectrum of this force, and you symmetrize it. This error I actually fixed. I made a mistake in recompiling. Sorry, that shouldn't happen. But so you symmetrize it. So you're looking at x of t, x of 0, plus x of 0, x of t. Because in general, x here is an operator, and it will not commute, in the interaction representation, it will not commute with itself at different times. But if you symmetrize it, you obtain the semi-classical noise spectrum. So if you do a noise measurement by literally multiplying the force at different times and averaging over everything, this is what you would measure. And this is given by J, this spectral density, times 1 plus 2n. N is the Bose function, the occupation number of the heat bath. And all of this together can also be written as hyperbolic cotangent of omega over 2t, which you, for example, saw extensively used in Andre's talk this morning. Now, it turns out that you can ask yourself, how general is this model? And if you track down what this is really doing, is that any delocalized thermodynamic environment, so any environment where you couple to, where you can do a good continuum limit, and where you are essentially not pushing the environment out of linear response, can be described this way. Because in that situation, the fluctuations coming from the environment will always be Gaussian, and this Hamiltonian gives you the most general possible Gaussian fluctuation. So the underlying degrees of freedom producing this can well be fermions, as long as we can obey this condition. Yeah? Oh, this is a function of omega. It is a function of omega, yeah. So if we want to match this to the electromagnetic environment, one easy way of doing this is you compare the noise spectrum produced by the model to the noise spectrum produced by your electromagnetic environment. So if you can write down an effective impedance, that, and you can use the Johnson-Nyquist formula, which tells you that the voltage noise will be given by this expression, 1 plus 2n, such as here, times the real part of the impedance times omega. And this is essentially a consequence of linear response theory. So that again tells us that if we can do linear response in talking to the environment, that ansatz is justified. An alternative approach for finding out J of omega for a given system is to not look at the noise, because that may be complicated, but to look at the friction which the environment induces on the quantum subsystem. The difficulty here is that for a classical friction for two-state system, it's a bit tricky, so you do the two-state approximation in the end. Yeah?
You don't have here an off-diagonal coupling.
Well, you could always rotate your bases such that the coupling operator is the...
You would have to deal with the diagonal.
That's right. So we assume that there is one fixed axis for each degree of freedom, yes. And that, for example, in the coupling to... in the coupling to phonon bars, that is actually very relevant. For those systems, we can get away with it, but thanks for the comment. That's very important. So how can we apply this to our superconducting systems? And this is, again, basically 5 years old, but it's a very nice playing ground. Let's look at the electronic circuitry which we use for putting microwaves down to our flux qubit. So this is producing flux noise, because between those two points we get voltage noise. That voltage noise leads to current noise, that leads to flux noise, which we can describe with this Hamiltonian. And the effective impedance here contains a parallel setting of this inductor and this line here, and these 50 ohms are the coaxial cable which the experimentalist connects to the chip, which inevitably has 50 ohms. So we need this effective impedance between those two points. We need to convert this into energy bias noise, and this is what we get. This is called the ohmic spectral density. It's proportional to omega. It has a cutoff at high frequencies. So this time tau is very, very short. In fact, this is given by L over R, the inductance over the total resistance here. And the prefactor is given, contains the effective impedance, it contains the mutual inductance from here to there, and it contains the circulating current. So these two guys convert the noise, the voltage noise, into energy level noise. Okay, so that's simple and straightforward. Let's look for something more. One thing to keep in mind is that this cutoff at high frequencies is actually necessary for keeping the model from diverging. So there's always a frequency above which we are losing spectral weight. It should be the total resistance. Sorry, the slides will be less sloppy soon. So if we know this, we can actually predict T1 and T2, and we can engineer the decoherence here based on the Bloch-Redfield equation, which is a master equation known from NMR. It can be derived if the coupling to the environment is weak and the memory time of the environment is short in a specific subtle combined way. And this gives rise to the usual T1 and T2 decoherence rates. So T1 corresponds to energy relaxation. Your qubit goes from one state to another, and because it's Fermi's golden rule, essentially, it creates an excitation in the bath of the same energy. So it's proportional to the noise power at an frequency given by the energy splitting of the qubit. That's simple. Now, for dephasing, you are getting a contribution from these T1 processes, but you're also getting a pure dephasing contribution, which contains S of zero, which basically tells us that we are not changing the population, we're just scrambling the phase, and it is accompanied by a quasi-elastic transition in the bath. You have to leave a trace in the bath, otherwise you wouldn't get decoherence, but you are only changing the energy by an infinitesimal amount. So it's not elastic, you're leaving a trace in the bath, but it still comes from the low-frequency part of the bath noise. You have prefactors here. This prefactor tells us how off-diagonal is the coupling to the environment, and this tells us how diagonal it is, how much do the energy levels fluctuate. So at the magic point, which Roger was emphasizing, for example, you put epsilon to zero because you want to couple to not couple to the slow degrees of freedom. Yes, because S indeed, even at zero temperature, is finite because of this one here. That's a spontaneous emission. There is a zero point term. The T1 rate is finite at zero temperature. Yeah, because S is J times 1 plus 2N. So the 1 in here is the zero point term. So this makes it easy. If you know your S from your impedance, and for example, it has this blue curve, which was the example from the previous slide, you can read off T1 and T2 by checking what's happening here, what's happening there. And by this, you can engineer decoherence properties. And now there's the immediate question, which I will answer not on the next part, but on the last part of the talk. If I manage to engineer an S with a gap, which doesn't have to be as hard as it is here, with a strong suppression at low frequencies, does this mean that I don't have decoherence? And I wouldn't ask the question if the answer was yes. But that just goes beyond this T1-T2 picture. But before I do this, let me introduce another tool, which is nonlinear circuitry. So here we are again coupling the qubit to a piece of electric circuit, but now this is the detector, and it contains Josephson junctions, which are nonlinear elements. And there, the mapping on the oscillator bus generally cannot be done because you're getting a non-trivial nonlinear response. What you can do in some cases, however, is you can linearize the system. So if you have a certain bias current through the squid and you have your external impedance here as a noise source, you can assume, okay, it doesn't change the bias current greatly. I linearize everything. And then this again looks like a linear circuitry. And for this specific example, where Z can be arbitrary and should be here, should be a real part of Z, we get this prefactor to J of omega, which comes from this linearization. Now, what things does it contain? It contains the flux through the squid, but it also contains the biasing current. And this is a very nice thing, because this formula tells us that if we have zero bias current through the squid, the noise does not talk to the qubit. Now, what is the physics of this? This is very nice, because that means that if we do not measure, the squid doesn't look to the qubit. So you can do the most important things with this quantum detector, which you have to do with a quantum detector, which is not use it. Because otherwise, if you observe a quantum system permanently, you run into all kinds of trouble. Now, what's the basis of this? It's very simple. If we have zero bias current, and if the junctions here are of equal size, this is a completely symmetric device with symmetric phase distribution, and all the current noise will split equally to the left and the right arm because of symmetry, and that does not produce flux noise. And actually, so for this decoupling, you have to make this very symmetric, and it turns out for demonstrating this, which has happened also last year in Delft, you have to pay attention to a certain type of fabrication phenomena, which have to do with the fact that you have two layers and three junctions. So if you go around the loop once and you start on the top layer, you will always be in the bottom layer. But this has been demonstrated to a high degree. But this really depends on the linearization. Yeah?
Is the mapping a bit more complicated in that you really want to have the noise associated with...
We want to have the noise... because this is essentially not an active element. It's basically a transducer for the noise, and the effective temperature still is the temperature of that resistor. There's no active element. It's basically a nonlinear passive element which couples to the noise. So, and it turns out because the plasma mode of this squid is very much like a harmonic oscillator, so the effective impedance which controls this would be peaked. But now we can ask ourselves, what happens if we don't measure? Still, we have a plasma mode, basically an LC resonator outside here. Only the coupling, the linear coupling, the coupling to A plus A dagger, the coordinate of the plasma mode, is zero. But that's a consequence of the linearization. So we can ask, what is the next term doing? And that brings us to the topic of nonlinear cavities. If you go through the same analysis, but instead of only keeping the linear coupling, you go to the quadratic coupling, you get this Hamiltonian. So this is again the qubit, and for technical reasons we have assumed that somebody has switched off the tunneling for us. So there was tunnel coupling in the past, and when we start the experiment we switch it off, which with Roger's setup you can do. That's a technical simplification for the calculation, it's not essential. This is the coupling to the harmonic oscillator, to the cavity mode, which couples to sigma z. And that harmonic oscillator has internal damping. But now you're coupling to the square of the coordinate. And this is the Hamiltonian which describes the heat bath and the coupling of the heat bath to the resonator. And again, if we would not couple to A plus A dagger squared, but to A plus A dagger, we could make a noble mode transformation, couple this onto the simple spin boson model with a funny spectrum, but everything would be exactly solvable with methods from the 1980s. But now we are coupling to A plus A dagger squared, so the classical statistics of the noise in this term would not be Gaussian, and we have to think about something else. And we want to allow for this coupling between this oscillator mode and the qubit to be arbitrarily strong. Now, one thing is that if all the superconducting technology part before you thought was a bit confusing and so on, and for example, if you're a quantum optician, you can start listening again, because that would be a cavity mode, that would be the leak in the cavity, and now just trust us, we have a mode how to couple to the square instead of the quadrature. Okay? And as I said, the unbiased squid would be a realization, but also in coplanar waveguide cavities, as they are studied in Yale, far off resonance, you can in principle get this as an effective Hamiltonian. So what do we do if the force here is not a quadrature of the harmonic oscillator, and if this coupling can be arbitrarily strong? Well, what we do not want to do is, so this is again the damping of the oscillator, what we do not want to do is a rotating wave approximation, because if this coupling becomes strong, we don't know how much we can trust that. What we also do not want to, the only small parameter which we want to have is K, kappa over omega, so we still assume that the harmonic oscillator is underdamped, has a Q factor significantly larger than 1. And the goal is to look at the back action of this and the decoherence induced by this, and we have additional results that will not show also on the resolution. And the problem is that because this is a non-Gaussian variable, we cannot integrate it out directly by established tools. But here's something we can do, and this is a pretty general approach. For systems where the trouble in your environment is in one prominent degree of freedom. Namely, instead of integrating out the whole damped oscillator, we are keeping the central oscillator and we're only integrating out the internal damping. The price to pay for this is that now, instead of looking at the density matrix of a two-state system, we are looking at a density matrix which is 2 by 2, but the entries here are infinite dimensional density matrices of the harmonic oscillator. So we get into a huge, huge system. And what we also do not want to do is we want to not truncate this at any finite number of levels. But after staring at this problem for a while, we looked at quantum optics literature, and there you can learn that you can express the density matrix, this infinite dimensional matrix, by a scalar function, and you can do this for all of these entries. In different ways, there's a whole family of phase space densities, and we have chosen chi, which is the generating function, the characteristic function of the Wigner function, and d is the displacement operator, so it takes you and displaces you in the x and p direction of the oscillator by an amount given by this complex number alpha. And if you do this, and you're writing down the complete a master equation for this 2 times infinite dimensional system, you're getting it exactly into this form. And what we're interested here is mostly the off-diagonal term, because this tells us the decoherence in the qubit. The diagonal terms would tell us the detector resolution. Yeah? Yes? We are treating, I don't know whether this answers your question, but we are treating the damping of the oscillator by a Born-Markov equation. So we are going around the usual Born-Markov approximation by making the system larger. Yeah. And we think it's justified because in the systems we're interested in, we are in the motion narrowing limit. So the memory time is much, much shorter than the damping rate. So we think this is a sound thing to do. I like to have them, but I don't believe in them in this specific system, in the experimental setups we're interested in. But we can talk about this later. So this leads to this generalized Fokker-Planck equation, and you see that the complexity of keeping an infinite density matrix is now has become the complexity of having a very potentially complicated function here. And in fact, this type of Fokker-Planck equation is extremely nasty because it contains first and second order derivatives. They are mixed, and you have this alpha and alpha star prefactors here, and you have this term which doesn't contain any derivatives. And in fact, this thing, what would be the total probability, so the complete integral over this is not conserved, which makes sense because we're only cutting out a part of the total system. We are losing coherence, so this is why the total thing goes down. And so we stared at this. We read the big book of Fokker-Planck equations. We became depressed for a week. But then we figured out that, hey, the initial state is a Gaussian, and it has a nice property. If you start the experiment, chi is a Gauss function. And if it's a Gauss function, it stays a Gauss function. And by this property, you can solve it numerically because a two-dimensional Gaussian is given by only a handful of parameters. And these are results from this, starting from what we call the phase Purcell effect. So these are numerical results, which we can also confirm analytically. So let's look at this first from a distance. Here are dephasing rates given in units of the oscillator eigenfrequency as a function of the coupling to the bath, so coupling between qubit and oscillator, for different damping strengths, so different Q factors of the cavity. And it's log-log, so this is a power law, which tells us that at weak coupling, well, we get back Fermi's golden rule. So that should be quadratic in the coupling of the qubit to the total environment. And because the coupling in our parameterization is goes as delta squared, this is a delta to the fourth law. At some slower coupling, Fermi's golden rule breaks down, and we're getting this plateau. And at very strong coupling, when delta becomes comparable to omega, hell breaks loose. But let's look at these two regimes. One thing we realize here is that these curves intersect, and in particular, the lowest dephasing rate, so the highest coherence here, is achieved with the highest Q factor of the cavity, so with the lowest cavity damping, whereas here, the highest quality is achieved with the highest cavity damping. So the more damped the cavity is, the more coherence we preserve here. And indeed, we can show if we do a cut through here and a cut through there, that the damping rate in this regime drops with increasing kappa, and here it grows with increasing kappa, and both are essentially linear or 1/linear. Now that looks pretty funny, in particular here, because that would indicate, look, you're completely taking away any damping, and suddenly you get this very short phase coherence time. Now that can't be true. But we believe it's true. And for completeness, let me show we can do a weak coupling expansion here, where we recover the Fermi's golden rule result from this more general theory, and we get a dephasing rate which is as 1/ kappa. For most realistic parameters, this part is not very important. And here we have the delta to the 4, and here we have the Bose function and 1 plus the Bose function. So at zero temperature, this only leads to energy shifts, but at finite temperature, it leads to dephasing. And this regime here has been found by other people before us, notably in Yale by Alexandre Blais. We gave it a name. We call it the phase Purcell effect. So recall the regular Purcell effect. What you are doing is you're putting an atom in a cavity. So you have your two-state system, and you couple it to a harmonic oscillator, and in the regular Purcell effect, you're coupling with A plus A dagger, and that oscillator has a certain leakage rate, so the cavity is not completely closed. And the spectral function from here is peaked at the eigenfrequency of the oscillator, and Purcell effect tells us that if we are now putting the energy splitting of the two-state system on resonance here, spontaneous emission will be faster. If we go far off resonance, it will be slower, both of these faster and slower as compared to vacuum. What we have here is we're not coupling to A plus A dagger, we're coupling to A plus A dagger squared, so we have to convolute this function with itself. It will have a peak at 2 omega and a peak at 0. But then we have the same physics, which is the more we reduce the damping, the higher the peak at zero becomes, and the faster we talk to the cavity. And for dephasing, we are interested in the zero frequency range of the noise. So this is so the zero frequency peak is exactly what we're interested in. So this is why we call this the Purcell effect for the phase instead of the energy. At strong coupling, that picture breaks down because we should not think about the leaky cavity as the environment seen by the qubit. We should look at the qubit coupled to the cavity as one quantum system and the leak as the environment. And then the compound quantum system decays as fast as its components. So the faster the cavity decays, the faster the qubit decays. And this is why, indeed, we get a nice scaling, which indicates that here the rate is proportional to kappa, and this tells us where the crossover is. And interestingly, there have been experiments on this system which has been analyzed in the weak coupling regime, both in Yale and Delft, but if you check whether you're in the weak and the strong coupling regime according to this criterion, well, they are in the strong coupling regime. Okay, I'm running quite behind time, but let me at least give you an idea what we can talk about later about what I actually announced in the abstract. And this is about visibility. Now here we are drastically for the first step to get to the main idea, we're drastically simplifying the spin boson model, which means we're kicking out the X term. We're still assuming that somebody has prepared the system in a sigma X eigenstate for us. We also assume that the initial conditions between system and bath are factorized. And I would later comment, but will not have time, what dropping these conditions means. And they have subtle consequences, but the general picture remains. If we have this, then this model can be very trivially integrated. Now, Bloch-Wettfield would tell us that this does not lead to energy relaxation, because here, again, the missing Z doesn't lead to flips. We only get a 1 over T2, which is equal to noise power at zero frequency. Now, this you can solve exactly. Everything commutes. You can look up the solution in Mayen, and let's look at the solution. So if you compute the expectation value of sigma x, it oscillates, it has Larmor precession, and it has this envelope function describing the decay, which in principle samples the noise power over all frequencies. Now, how does this sampling look like? Well, at long times, it turns out this kernel goes to a delta function. So if I draw this kernel, which I call C here, at very long times, we really have a peak at zero frequency. And if the environmental spectrum, for example, is gapped, that will not have much of an overlap. If we go to shorter times, however, there is lots of overlap, so this K is finite. If you do the long time expansion more carefully, you see that K of T starts with T over T2, where T2 is the regular Bloch-Wettfield formula. This is what you would get from a Markovian equation. But then you have a subleading term which is constant, which I call log V, and then there are terms which actually disappear at long times. So that means if you observe the system at a relatively long time, this envelope will have exponential T2 decay, but the prefactor is not 1. Call this the visibility, and that's essentially the Cauchy mean value of the integral over the noise over omega squared. So that tells us that if we have a gapped environment like this, where orthodox Bohr-Markov theory would tell us infinite coherence, that's not true, because we are, at least this visibility prefactor will be finite due to short time effects. But if you have resolution on the amplitude of your signal here, if you can measure this, you see that these short time effects have a long time consequence because you have lost amplitude, you have lost contrast. So in a gapped environment, if you just work out this integral, because this can in most cases be done analytically, you see that the amplitude drops, and then you have an oscillation which more or less stays level. There's a bit of beating on here. And Bloch-Wettfield would tell us, well, your amplitude just stays constant. So the rate at long times is okay. It's okay predicted by Bohr-Markov theory, but the amplitude is off. And this loss of visibility are a common plague in superconducting qubits. Now, how can we understand this? This is a reminder, these are the T1 and the T2 processes, but in a gapped environment, we do not have the ability to dump the energy we want, which in this case would actually be zero energy, to the environment, but we can still make a higher order process, excite and de-excite the degree of freedom in the environment, which makes sense. Higher order, this gives us its energy penalty. However, for leaving a trace in the environment, what you do not want to do is to do something which is completely virtual, because that would only lead to renormalization. So you need to have an existing excitation which you can dump down. And for this, it's important to have extra energy in the system. So this is why this only works for non-equilibrium initial states, such as the factorized state. So this is one message I want to bring across, that the factorized initial state, which everybody assumes in quantum open quantum systems theory, is a non-equilibrium state. It has extra energy. The equilibrium state of the system would be a dressed state of the qubit. For a gapless environment, this initial drop is superimposed with exponential decay. You can accommodate more general initial conditions. These are initial conditions where the bath modes are shifted in phase space, and each of them individually. And what you can show is that there's one set of initial conditions which we call the optimal dressed state, where essentially the qubit is in superposition of left and right, and you're shifting the oscillators accordingly. And that would not have any finite, it would have an infinity too, but it has the longest visibility in the long run. And that has to do with the fact that the long visibility, the reduced visibility in the long run is due to the fact that if you're in dressed state and you're measuring a qubit observable, such as sigma x, you actually have to overlap the two dressing clouds. And just to flash this, you're supposed to learn what you can discuss with me here. I know that this is too fast. Is that for gapped environments, you can go beyond this independent boson model, because if the environment is gapped, so if the minimum frequency of your environment is higher than your qubit energies, you're getting a new small parameter in the problem, which is the qubit energy. And you can work out that gapped model, and you're getting essentially the same dynamics as in the purely phasing case, with the additional feature what you should have is that tunneling slows down due to Frank-Condon effect, or due to the same effect which, for example, gives also rise to the dissipative phase transition, which just by symmetry was absent in the previous case. So there is a way for isolating the non-Markovian effects in these gapped environments. And by this, the least thing you learn is under which condition your Markovian approximation is still okay. So I realized that in the end it was fast. Again, I'll be here all 3 days. So talk to me if you want to know more about this. So I've introduced superconducting qubits, described how we described decoherence due to the circuitry, talked about decoherence in nonlinear cavities and these visibility effects. These are my sponsors. And the introduction to superconducting qubits we've summarized in these two papers, which should become book chapters. That's on qubit design, that's on decoherence. This is the nonlinear cavity work, and this is the visibility work. Thanks for your attention.